Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
All right. Good morning. Let everyone get settled. Go ahead and have a seat. We're here this morning on 2205 in the matter of the amendment of Supreme Court Rules 21.15 and 21.0 relating to electronic banking. As I understand it, we have two presenters and one speaker. Is there anyone else who wishes to be heard or be on the list? Not that we know of so far. Okay. If someone changes their mind, you're welcome to let us know what your thoughts are. Let's start with Mr. Samuelson.
Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court. Tim Samuelson, I'm the Director of the Office of Lawyer Regulation. On behalf of OLR, together with my colleague Travis Steeren, we filed Petition 2205 to amend Supreme Court to allow electronic transactions in lawyer trust accounts. Wisconsin's an outlier. We're the only state.
Maybe raise that a little bit. I know sometimes it's hard to hear with the acoustics. On the right-hand side, yeah, perfect.
I didn't want to shout at the court.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Chief Justice Ziegler. Wisconsin's an outlier. We're the only state that generally prohibits electronic transactions in client trust accounts. Although the proposed amendment applies electronic transactions in these types of accounts, they still maintain sufficient procedural safeguards, some in more respects, and will continue to protect the public. This morning, I'll briefly address three points before ceding the floor, with the Court's consent, to Mr. Steeren, who is OLR's Trust Account Program Administrator. I'll do my best to answer any questions, but would respectfully suggest that I may be better equipped to respond to questions of policy and procedure, and Mr. Steeren is best suited to address the substantive details. He's been with OLR for 19 years, has been involved in prior amendments, and has a deep understanding of the rule and its granular detail. Then Tim Pierce, Ethics Counsel for the State Bar and Staff Liaison to the State Bar Standing Committee on Ethics, will also discuss the petition, some of the proposed comments, and some other issues. My three points are, why this, why now, and if granted, when effective. First, why this? Footnote 16 on page 8 alludes to further simplifications in the trust account rule. So that begs the question, why this? Why limit this petition to electronic transactions? Why not address the rest of 21.15? After all, it is the longest, most complex trust account rule in the country. Well, that's because there is a need and there's a consensus. In the 18 months I've served in my role, I've engaged in outreach, not just in Madison, Milwaukee, but across all 72 counties. And a common sentiment I've heard is that our trust account rule needs attention. A concern that I have been told repeatedly is that the rule as written limits a lawyer's ability to receive advanced fees. It presents administrative burdens and may limit client choice. And this particularly affects small and solo practitioners. So there's a need. And there's also a consensus. Mr. Steeren and I, before filing our petition, engaged in a significant amount of outreach. We talked to stakeholders, persons who were involved in prior amendments, the State Bar leadership, its committees and sections, and several affected trade organizations. And I'm pleased to announce that they all broadly support Petition 2205. As is customary, the Court sent out its interested persons letters, and four letters were received, exclusive of OLRs, and all four support the petition. I am unaware of any individual or group that opposes 2205. Why now?
Let's hope you don't lose this, then.
Let's hope. Why now? There's a need that's urgent. In fact, Justice Bradley, there has been a triggering event, and by that I mean that subsection FC3 may no longer even be viable. That's a subsection that allows for an alternative procedure for e-banking and trust accounts so long as the lawyer purchases a bond and insurance. It's colloquially referred to as the all-in-one policy. However, the only insurer that had been writing this type of policy no longer writes it. So this alternative procedure is no longer a viable option. So even if a lawyer wanted to comply with subsection FC3, they couldn't. So now there's just one less way for lawyers to comply with the rule as written. So there's some urgency. And finally, when effective? I mean, that is, if the court were to grant the petition, what should the effective date be? Our memorandum requested January 1st, 2023, but that is obviously passed. So today I want to make clear that our request is that if granted, the court passes an effective date of July 1st, 2023. Now that's coming up quickly. It's about 4 months away. However, I'm confident that in partnership with the state bar, we can educate lawyers throughout the state, engage in outreach, provide reference materials so that our lawyers understand an amendment and what it means for them. And what would that look like? Well, there's six specific types of things that we do. First, publication, both print and electronic. We'd work with the state bar to have an article printed in the Wisconsin Lawyer. They also do the Inside Track biweekly newsletter where information is blasted out to lawyers across the state. One of their regular columns is What Lawyers Should Know. That's a nuts and bolts discussion of a rule change or changes in the law. We can do that. Sample language. When 1.5G was created, we worked with the state bar to create sample language and model forms. Third, outreach. Over the last year, I've engaged in a lot of outreach. I went to over 20 counties in the state of Wisconsin last year, and I plan to keep it up again this year. This will be a topic of conversation. OLR's materials. We have a dedicated website to the Trust Account Program. What we will do is update our materials, revise our manual, create forms, and post them on our website where they're free of charge to lawyers. Stakeholders. The same stakeholders we met with on the front end will work with on the back end to ensure that they're on the same page. And then finally, Trust Account School. Every fall, Mr. Stern presents a three-hour seminar to explain the nuance of the trust account rule. Not just him, but members of trade associations, whether it's the banking industry or others, and also private practitioners that he's worked with in the past. We'll do that. A topic of the trust account school will be prospective changes to 21.15 if the court were to pass our petition. Now, the proposed amendment does not require any affirmative steps by a lawyer to be in compliance. Said differently, if a lawyer is in compliance on June 30, she'll also be in compliance on July 1st. The rule, modifications or amendments to the rule will allow lawyers to modify their practice at their own speed. Bottom line, I'm confident that OLR and the State Bar will be able to educate lawyers even with the July 1st deadline. In closing, I request the court grant petition 2205. I'd be happy to answer any questions the court may have. Otherwise, Mr. Stern can address the particulars.
All right.
Thank you, Justice.
You sent a letter asking for a correction.
Yes, Your Honor.
You wanted to address that. I think the letter is January 13th, 2023.
We actually addressed two letters, and one was addressing some of the comments to the proposed amendments. And part of the question was, do the comments address substantive changes to the rule? And Mr. Pierce will address this in greater detail, but part of the reason for the proposed comments is to affirmatively address questions that Mr. Pierce receives and Mr. Stern receives. Mr. Stern receives calls from lawyers all over the state on a daily basis asking about the trust account rule. And this is intended to provide guidance to the bar. One of the other letters, I believe that the January letter, addressed some Scrivener's errors that we've tried to clarify for the court, so we're being clear with what our request is.
Counsel, so there's one of the pieces of language in here. Lawyers shall replace any and all funds that have been withdrawn from a trust account by a financial institution or card issuer and reimburse the trust account for any shortfall or negative balance caused by a chargeback, surcharge, or ACH reversal within 3 business days of receiving notice, and the lawyer shall reimburse for any chargeback, surcharge, or ACH reversal. Could you explain the rationale for that, and then maybe I have a couple of follow-ups to that.
Yes, Justice Hagedorn. My understanding, and again, Mr. Stern is the subject matter expert, but my understanding is that maintains the status quo under the alternative procedures, which do, under the existing rule, allow for electronic transactions. In the event of a chargeback, the lawyer is ultimately responsible for ensuring the positive balance in a trust account. Now, there are third-party services that are advertised, and I don't want to advocate for one in particular, but they have a modest fee to essentially allow any overages to be compensated out of a business account as opposed to a trust account. So that's one potential remedial measure a lawyer can affirmatively take to avoid any chargeback concerns. But at the end of the day, it's ultimately the lawyer's responsibility for ensuring that a trust account is sufficiently funded.
What if there's, a mistake of some sort? Technically, this rule maybe could be read to require sort of reimbursement for some mistaken, or what if there's a genuine dispute of some sort?
And that's one reason we have time. And so to address that would give the lawyer time to reconcile. Or if the lawyer is concerned about the that's one reason why he or she could use a third-party service. For example, the State Bar is in partnership with one of them, advertises it on its website, and for a modest fee of $20 a month, they can essentially insure against that type of overage.
Does it make sense, though, to have that mandate when there is a genuine dispute of some sort?
Unfortunately, I have to punt. I think Mr. Stern has a better understanding of that. I don't mean to
That's fine.
Advocate
yeah.
my
Someone else is better equipped okay. to address it. That's great. So.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Stern.
Good morning, Justices. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Thank you. As Mr. Samuelson said, the long and short of it is lawyers need to be able to make electronic transactions in trust accounts. As part of my role with the trust account program, I've attended several payments industry conferences over the last couple of years with the Wisconsin ACH Association, now known as the Mid-Atlantic ACH Association, or MACHA. And through those conferences, I saw a number of presentations by payments industry professionals, and basically the long and short of it is checks are being used less and less and less, and electronic payments are going up and up and up, and I think that's no surprise to any of us. They basically concluded that while checks will still be used for large commercial transactions, big business closings and things, by and large, we're going to be using electronic payments everywhere else. And I think that's reflected in our personal lives. I mean, I know I can count on one hand the number of paper checks I've written in the last year. And the fact of the matter is lawyers need to be able to have access to all the tools that everyone else does, other industries, and we do in our personal lives. In 2004, Wisconsin became the only state prohibiting electronic transactions in trust accounts. And the result of that is lawyers now can functionally only get paid by cash, check, money order, or wire transfer. It's difficult for many people needing representation to pay lawyers. Lots of low-income people just don't have cash up front. That's just the fact. And also, the other effect of that is lawyers can only pay by check or by wire transfer. Increasingly, lawyers need to be able to make electronic transactions for fee payments into different court fees, for tax payments to the IRS, unclaimed property. There's a number of areas where lawyers need to be able to move funds out of their trust account directly without putting them into their business account first. And I think this was something that became pretty clear quickly after 2004. Our rule was modified in both 2007 and then again in 2016 to allow for e-banking trust accounts and the all-in-one trust account. As Tim explained, the all-in-one trust account may no longer be available. So that's one exception that's pretty much uncertain at this point. And the e-banking trust account acts as kind of a deterrent to small firms, because in those cases, lawyers will have to have, in order, if they want to accept electronic payments, they have to have two trust accounts. They have to have their regular IOLTA, then they have to have an e-banking IOLTA, which basically they accept payments and then move them over. So the result of that is the lawyers have the administrative costs of just upkeeping two accounts, two sets of books, and the cost of the, of having two accounts. And it's while some larger firms, that's no problem for them, but the small practitioners and solo firms, those are the ones who are having a real issue just keeping up with that as well as their day-to-day business. We find that some people just bypass using the trust account entirely and opt for the alternative protection for advanced fees provided by 20:1.5 sub G, which was another exception that was carved out to allow for electronic payments. And that was, I believe, in 2007 or maybe in 2012. What that basically does is allows attorneys to accept advanced fees directly to their business account if they provide additional security measures. Basically, they have to agree to binding fee arbitration. They have to provide accountings and give notices thereof at the front end and the back end of the representation. So a lot of lawyers are using that just because they don't want to deal with the e-banking trust account. We're also finding, anecdotally, we hear, you know, from people, they just go ahead and accept electronic payments anyway because they need to get paid. So it's a big problem. I want to basically address the two kind of underlying problems with electronic transactions that the 2004 prohibition was kind of designed to address. Those are basically that the lack of a paper trail for electronic transactions. There's a perceived problem for accounting for electronic transactions. The second one being the reversals and fees issue that Justice Hagedorn already mentioned. So starting first, you know, for the last 19 years I've been with OLR, at the outset, there was always the feeling, the belief that there had to be a literal paper trail for every transaction. That's why we had to have checks with notations for the client's client matter or purpose of the check on the check. The fact of the matter is, in today's world, a literal paper trail doesn't exist. Checks themselves, after the banks receive them, they take an image of the check, and the check's almost instantly destroyed. And then the lawyers ultimately can get those back with their bank statements, but that's all provided electronically. So the literal paper trail thing just doesn't exist in today's world. But the banking industry has basically made up for that issue by having extra safeguards in transactions. For every electronic payment at the outset, there's an affirmative prior record of authorization. That's when you sign in and you have to check that box that says, yep, I'm agreeing to pay this. So that's a record that's in the electronic system, the banking system, that says, this person signed in, they approved this payment. And along with it, this the payment itself, there's an 80-character addenda record. It's the electronic version of the memo line. So for every ACH payment, you can put in, what's this for? So there's an opportunity to keep a record and associate it with a particular purpose. And that's even more reliable than the memo line, because both banks have to keep the record, that 80-character addenda record, for a period of 6 years after the transaction. So the originating institution has to keep a record of that, and the receiving institution. So the banks keep a hold of those in case their account holders need that record for any reason. And normally that record will come up in your bank statement under the details of a transaction. You'll see, you know, the payee and what it was for if you've made a note of that. So that's basically how the paper trail works these days. And with respect to reversals, in this day and age, most electronic payments are now non-reversible. Wire transfers have always been allowed. They're non-reversible bank-to-bank transfers. Similarly, Zelle payments, which a lot of us have with our banks, that's a non-reversible transfer. It goes straight from your bank to the other bank. It clears instantly. It can't be withdrawn. ACH payments, which are basically electronic checks, debit cards, and so forth, those are only reversible if there's an error reported to the bank in 5 days. And that error has to be, it can't be a refund or something of that effect. The error has to be like the actual name of the payee or the amount of it was a mistake in the payment itself. So those are the only ways that those kind of payments can be reversed. Third-party apps such as PayPal, Venmo, and so forth, those are what's known as credit push transactions. So the account holder, the person who has the money in their Venmo account, pushes it out to the payee, and once the payee gets it, it can't be reversed. So those are effectively, once they're through, they're through. The one remaining thing is credit cards. Those two still do have that risk of reversal or a chargeback for a refund, that kind of thing, or challenge. Also processing fees associated with them. And the way other states have dealt with this issue is basically you can accept credit card payments to trust accounts. It's the vast majority of states. I found guidance in 35 states plus the District of Columbia at least that have published recent guidance suggesting that the way to handle this is you have one of these services, and there are some. There's one service that is approved by all 50 state bar associations, credit card processor. They also manage, you know, time and billing. It's a full suite of software needs for accounting for attorneys. But what they do is they're able to channel any chargebacks or processing fees have to come out of the business account, whereas the funds that go to the trust account stay there. So if there's any chargeback, it has to be, they basically have two merchant accounts. They have your one account tied to your operating account, and that's for fees and processing and chargebacks, and the other one is where the money goes that they receive. It goes straight to your trust account. So there is a way to insulate.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yes.
Can you slow down just a little bit for one?
Sure.
I'm trying to follow you, but I do the same thing. So I'm just thinking about like the PayPal and the Venmo and the not being able to reverse because, I'll speak for myself. Right, so for PayPal, I've got that. I think that goes through my credit card, right? And that's a push. That's what you're calling a push, right? Mm-hmm. But you can, if there's a mistake, you can revert. Because it's tied to that to a credit card, can't you reverse that?
Well, if it's tied to a credit card, there's the possibility of reversal with other credit card payments.
Okay.
But a lot of people have it tied to their debit or their checking account,
right,
or what have you.
Like,
or they fund it, if they pre-fund it from their account and then they have a pool of it sitting in Venmo, once that's gone, it's hard to get that back. Venmo's just not going to help you out. Once it's already gone, they kind of wash their hands.
Okay.
Of it.
Yeah. Okay. So if it's the pool of money there, because all your friends have Venmo'd you and you've got the money in there and you haven't transferred it back to your bank, that you can't reverse.
Right.
If it's tied to your credit card, you can reverse it. And if it's tied to your bank,
If it's tied to your bank, it's considered to be an ACH payment, and those are very hard to reverse. The credit card, credit cards, whether it's reversible, as my understanding, it all depends on their policies and their agreements with their cardholders.
Whether or not it's fraud, maybe, or something like that. Okay.
Right.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Justice. So, as I was saying, that ability to isolate and insulate that trust account may not have existed in 2004, but it does exist now because there's an industry built around that. And there's one that's recommended by the state bars, but there's also four or five different competitors who are also very reputable. And it's my understanding that banks themselves, if you set up credit card processing into your bank, they're able to do that as well. So there are a number of options. But there's another alternative which we've proposed in our petition, and that's under 20:1.15 sub B, sub 6B. And in this case, we're just kind of like the 1.5G exception now. We temporarily allow attorneys to accept credit card payments or any other transaction to their operating account. So long as they quickly move it over to their trust account. And this is by rule, it's done in Maine and in North Dakota, and also Connecticut and Minnesota now use this. And their argument is basically, although you do need to hold funds in trust, just accepting the funds is just the means of payment. Once you've got it, it has to be put into the trust account. Much like if someone gives you a check late on Friday afternoon or Saturday afternoon, you used to not be able to deposit till Monday, so you'd hold on to it in your safe or something, kind of like that. That's the attorney's holding it, but it doesn't have to put it in the trust account until it's practical to do so. And so we think this is an option for, especially for small practitioners, that will allow them just to have one credit card processing account set up so they can accept both advanced fees and earned fees. This one payment for both can go right to your operating account. Any advanced fees can move over to the trust account. And again, in that case, any reversals or chargebacks. At the end of the day, if you're unable to isolate the trust account or something happens, the attorney is the fiduciary. It's their duty to get the funds back. If they choose to accept credit card payments, you know, this, it's part of the risk. They have to set it up correctly, and if not, at the end of the day, it's their duty to put the funds back if anything goes missing. One more thing that I've learned from Macha in my research is that electronic transactions are now considered safer than checks. Electronic transactions, there's a thing called FedNow, which is supposed to be taking place in 2023, maybe pushed back completely to 2024, in which any electronic transaction through the federal banking system clears within seconds. If you're at Target and you run your card, if you check your bank account within seconds, it'll be gone. Electronic payments are clearing much more quickly. The result of that is there's less lag time. There's used to be there you could float a check, you know, and some people could deposit a check twice or so forth, something like that. That can't happen with electronic transactions. Once it's done, the money's gone. That's it. So you have to be careful. You get everything right at the outset, but they're very reliable because the banking system now is working to instant payments in the very, very near future. And there are also lots of new reasonable security measures that banks have in place and the payments industry have in place. First of all, we're all familiar with having your bank account, your password and your username and all that just to get in to do anything. There are two-factor authentication things where you go to try to make a payment and they say, well, we're going to send a code to your phone or to your email. You have to confirm that. That's two-factor authentication. So that's what a lot of payments require now. And there are also things like security tokens, which are things that are updated daily. The bank will give you a little mechanical token, and every day there's a new code on the token. And that's a way to confirm that you are the account holder. So there are a lot of those things that are in place, and the banks are updating those constantly to kind of stay ahead of the fraudsters, basically. But what Macha found is that checks are still commonly forged. I sat through several seminars, and basically there's a big, big problem with cashier's checks. And we see this with lawyers as well. What happens is the fraudsters are somehow getting really good at forging the micro numbers even. They can forge every part of a cashier's check now. So as a result, a lot of banks are holding cashier's checks longer, and they're checking with the maker bank to ensure it's a real check before it clears, because this is a big problem, and they're struggling with it. So if you do actually get a cashier's check, the best thing to do is to check with the other bank, make sure it's real. That's what we always recommend. We're also seeing situations where lawyers get their checks or their checkbook taken, or someone that they've sent like a small check or $50 to, you know, their husband or someone else gets a hold of it. They change the payment amount or they change the payee, so they're able to use that paper check and basically forge new amounts or to create new checks. And this is something that's common currently with paper checks, but it's not happening with electronic transactions. And one more point to kind of note is that many of our lawyers and potential clients have never used a paper checkbook. A lot of people coming out of law school have just never had one. And we're now expecting them to walk into a law firm and be able to do that when they're like, why can't I just, you know, do an ACH payment? That's how I do everything else. So that's, you know, that's just kind of brings home the fact that, wow, you know, I'm getting old. And, you know, we've got to keep up with the times. And what we're trying to do with this rule is to keep up with the times. So basically what I want to say is that allowing lawyers to use modern banking methods will make it easier for potential clients, especially low-income people and small practitioners. It'll make it easier for them to get paid, and will make it easier for lawyers to pay as well when they need to. The proposed amendments will simplify one of the longest and most complex trust account rules in the country. Lawyers will be able to comply as it's much closer to how they bank in their personal lives. Requiring paper checks is simply antiquated at this point. It's not practical in today's world. As Tim explained, we believe the transition to the new rule will be relatively straightforward, at least for attorneys. If they already have an e-banking trust account, there's nothing to prevent them to keep on doing that. They can maintain two trust accounts. If it's working for them, they like it. They'll like the security of that. If they have the support staff support that, that's great. But any lawyer who currently has one trust account, they don't have to start taking electronic payments, but if they choose to do so, they can start doing so as long as they, you know, take care of the reversal fee issue, and then also enter into fee agreements clarifying with their client if any processing fees, how are those going to be handled, if it's going to be passed on or not. Yes.
Your presentation
yes.
has been
super interesting. I feel like Jill got some free legal advice down there.
Good, and I'm glad it's not just my kids who have no idea whatsoever what a check is.
That's right.
Yeah. I heard someone the other day said that. Well, thank you for the comment, Justice, Chief Justice.
I think just, the sense lean that in. Rebecca Bradley, lean? Justice Bradley, has a question for you.
Please.
Thank you very much for your presentation. Just a few questions for you. Should the proposed amendment to the rule include language indicating that the chargeback reimbursement must be made from the firm's business account? Because it doesn't specify where the reimbursement comes from.
It does not specify that. That's true. We believe it's part of the primary rule to hold funds in trust. And to care for those funds, and if anything should happen, an attorney always has the duty to replace funds. Again, I've looked at the rules in every other state, and there's no other state that addresses that specifically in the rule, although a lot of them offer ethics opinions or guidance that recommend that process. A lot of them are published on the websites of our contemporary, our counterparts.
I'm just wondering if we should make it crystal clear, because I know there's been some OLR action sometimes informally taken against attorneys who are trying to comply, but they're confused, especially, you know, the reference was made to smaller firms. Larger firms have more resources to equip them to comply with the rules. I just want to make sure that it's crystal clear to attorneys who are kind of trying to do this on their own.
And that's a great point, Justice Bradley. If the court believes that we'd be better off placing it there in the rule, that's something we would certainly consider. But we believe offering guidance and training, part of the goal was to simplify the rule and to make it more manageable, because quite frankly, a lot of attorneys' their eyes just glaze over. Even my other investigators at OLR, I have to explain the rule every time with them. So we're trying to make it something that's more manageable. But if you think that's a part of something that should be added, that it's, we'd certainly welcome the consideration of that, yes.
Another question. The proposed amendment prohibits attorneys from accepting additional electronic deposits before they cover a chargeback. The covering of the chargeback might happen pretty quickly, but is that intended to prevent attorneys from accepting electronic deposits from other clients or from this particular client?
That is there to prevent them from accepting payments from other clients, so that those other clients' funds wouldn't be used to cover that chargeback. The idea is you need to cover that chargeback, either work it out with that client, get that payment sorted out, or cover it yourself before taking any other third party's funds.
Do you think that might be, I mean, is that, maybe that's not a problem for the clients, but it's a problem for attorneys. Again, I'm thinking more of, actually, this might be a problem for big firms that are accepting lots of deposits, and I'm not sure how they'd be able to comply with that.
It is a little bit similar. We have some large firms that do collection account work, and this is an issue that comes up where, you know, people who pay their collections sometimes don't cut bad checks, and so we see overdrafts a lot for these collection accounts where there is a reversal. And we see overdrafts because of that. And those firms that we work with, there's a few larger ones, they're able to keep track of that. They have a manager or accountant of some sort who addresses those almost on a daily basis. I'm not sure if that answers your question, but they are able to cope with that issue. And they are high volume attorneys who have, you know, they're dealing with hundreds of transactions every week, and they're able to adjust and make sure that they reconcile the accounts, you know, if there is a chargeback. And I would say we see those, there's one particular firm I'm thinking of, we see three or four overdrafts a year that happen because of that, and they're able to take care of it within 2 or 3 days tops. So
you don't think this is a concern?
I don't see that as a major concern for most businesses.
I think one more question, and I'm sorry if this has already been addressed, but it's a lot of information in an area that I don't know that we're all that familiar with collectively. But if a client's credit card is charged as a mistake, why would the lawyer have to reimburse the trust account for funds that shouldn't have been deposited in the first place, assuming the attorney doesn't withdraw the money because it was a mistake?
In a case such as that, if there is a mistake as to the amount or whether the two charges go through or something like that, then the lawyer would be able to provide a refund to them, or they would need to replace that, the funds in those types of situations where the funds are intended to be dispersed back out. If it's the situation where, like, hey, I was supposed to have $5,000 in advance fees here, and I didn't, you took it back out, I need to put it in there. But if I accidentally got $10,000, and the lawyer's perfectly welcome to refund, their work that out with the client in that situation.
So in that instance, would the attorney still have to reimburse the trust account because the money wouldn't have come out? Do you know what I'm saying?
I do understand what you're saying. If there is a mistake, at the end of the day, it's up to the attorney and the client to work out the amount, the proper amount that the attorney should have received. And if the attorney is no longer, if a reversal takes out a part that they were not allowed, that they weren't required, by agreement to have in their trust account, then I think it would be compliant with the rule if they wouldn't be required to put in funds that shouldn't be held in trust. They should only be having in the trust account what the client believes they should be holding at the end of the day.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that answers it clearly, but that is a great point, and that's something we'll consider for clarification and training purposes. Thank you.
I'm just wondering if we should adjust the language a little bit to make it clear that if the money isn't actually withdrawn from the trust account, there's nothing to reimburse.
That's definitely a consideration. The language that we use as a point of reference for that provision is mirrors the language that we currently have under the existing e-banking trust account rule. So that's the way we've been doing it since 2012. So.
Thank you.
Anything else?
There, just to clarify in this, because obviously this impacts different, firms different ways, but I assume that big law firms, medium-sized law firms, small law firms, solo practitioners, when I think about the way we administer this stuff, I would like to make it as cheap and easy and clear as possible for everybody. Have you received any concern from any of those different sectors with their ability to comply with this rule or logistically handle it? Or do you think it falls on any of them in any weightier way than others from an administration standpoint?
That point hasn't been raised as concern with the constituencies. I spoke with a number of the litigation and the family law and criminal law practice section heads, and that was not raised. I would answer that's it's the price of doing business. If you're going to want to accept electronic payments, which everyone kind of wants to do, there's going to be some cost, and you're going to have to arrange for that. So if at the end of the day, it's going to facilitate their business and allow them to earn more. So I think that's the cost of business attorneys are willing to go. But again, there are a number of services now, and it's a relatively straightforward process, as I understand it. You have a monthly fee, and then there's per transaction fees. But once you get it set up and running, it's pretty smooth.
Anything else? All right. Thank you very much. Very informative.
Thank you.
Attorney Pierce.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Tim Pierce. I work at the State Bar. I'm ethics counsel for the State Bar, and I am here to express on behalf of the State Bar's Ethics Committee our unalloyed enthusiasm for this petition. yes, unalloyed enthusiasm and trust accounting. The two can go together. I'll be as brief as I can, but just to give some background, I worked at the Office of Lawyer Regulation from 96 to 2004, and from 2004 to today, I've been at the State Bar, so I've been trying to explain Wisconsin's trust account rule to lawyers since 1996. And I've been involved in all the previous iterations of changes and tweaks we've made to the trust account rule, and this is the first time we're making it simpler and easier to use since I've been around. And as somebody who's paid to spend time talking to lawyers every day about problems and trying to explain the trust account rule, I can say I have spoken to many callers about this pending petition, and I've received nothing but please, please, please let it pass responses from the practicing bar. So I have to compliment Mr. Samuelson and Mr. Stearin for their collegiality in working with us at the State Bar on this petition. In fact, if my recollection serves me correctly, the first time I had a chance to sit down with Mr. Samuelson, I said, perhaps we could do something about Wisconsin's trust account rule. And here we stand today, thanks to the excellent efforts of Mr. Stearin and Mr. Samuelson, and I want to reassure the court that if you do adopt the early date of July 1st, as stated by Mr. Samuelson, no lawyer will be caught in a trap. They don't have to stop doing anything by virtue of this petition. And we at the State Bar are already in the process of planning and setting out the education that we're going to do for lawyers. So I don't think adopting a new rule on July 1st would pose problems for the practicing bar. And as a plug for future lawyers coming into the practice, I've been lucky enough to teach professional responsibility at UW Law School for 12 years now. And just as a little bit of the cranky law instructor, I force my law students to look at Wisconsin's trust account rule. I do not test them on it, but I force them to look at it. And it's safe to say they are both frightened and appalled by the complexity of it. So I think for the future ongoing practice of law, this would be a positive step for all lawyers practicing and those in. And I do want to comment, I've had experience in the regulatory agency and in advising lawyers. I don't think that this affects client safety one way or another. It's simply inconceivable for any service provider or merchant that you wouldn't routinely use electronic transactions to handle banking that a service provider like a lawyer does in this day and age. And at least to my knowledge, Mr. Samuelson can certainly speak more to it than I can, but I closely follow disciplinary proceedings across the country, not just in Wisconsin, as part of my job. I'm unaware of sorts of problems arising from the looser electronic transaction regime you see in all other 49 states. So I personally do not view this as a threat to client safety. Last, I would make a pitch for the court to adopt the petition in its entirety. What we're really doing here, or we're proposing, is to make it simpler for lawyers in Wisconsin. And as I stated, I worked with Mr. Stearin in going through drafts. So some of the comments that are not directly related to electronic banking were at my request, because in my experience over the last 20 years of answering questions from lawyers and office managers and account managers at law firms and explaining the trust account rule to them, these were some of the issues I see as being unclear in the rules. So, for example, to make it plain that you can't use your trust account to park funds that are not related to your work as a lawyer, while it's alluded to in other sections of the trust account, if you're a lawyer trying to figure that out, reading the black letter, it's not there. So my suggestion, why don't we make it there? Similarly, I've had numerous questions over the past 20 years about electronic payments and fees. Does the lawyer have to eat the fees, or can they agree with the client to do that? So similarly, I really thought it was important to clarify in the comments the procedure that the lawyer could use to do that. So I would urge the court to adopt the petition in its entirety, simply in keeping with the spirit of trying to make the rule more usable and more simple for Wisconsin lawyers. And again, to reassure the court, that we at the State Bar stand ready. In fact, we're already involved in the process of planning education with respect to the rule should the court choose to adopt it. With that, I will conclude my remarks. I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone would have.
I simply comment on the difference between this hearing dealing with trust accounts and electronic banking as we're dealing with it now. In contrast, and you were there, as was a courtroom almost full of people, the prior hearing raised substantial issues. And you know, this is one where there seems to be, but for a few questions raised, such unanimity and almost joy seen in the faces of people that are appearing before us, particularly yours, because you have lived this journey. So thank you for your effort.
Well, thank you, Justice Bradley. I appreciate that. And strange as it might seem, I'm very excited about this trust account petition.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else who wishes to be heard on this matter before we conclude for the day? All right. There seems to be no one else who wishes to comment on this particular rule matter. With that, I just wish to commend the director and those who have engaged in the outreach that you have. It's been very well received around the state, and on behalf of the court, we thank you as well. That's something that we were hoping to see and now are seeing the fruits of that. So thank you for your good work. All right. Let's meet in closed conference at 10:30.